Let me extend to you all a very warm welcome to the series of Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh for the academic session 2016 to 2017. My name is Stuart Brown, and I am Professor of Ecclesiastical History and also Deputy Convener of the Gifford Lectureships Committee. Allow me first to say a few words about the Gifford Lectures before I introduce our speaker. The Gifford Lectures were established in 1885 by a gift from Adam Lord Gifford, a justice of the Court of Session and a man of broad learning, compassion, and cultivation. He endowed a series of public lectures at each of the four older Scottish universities, Edinburgh, St. Andrews, Glasgow, and Aberdeen, for, as he put it, promoting, advancing, teaching, and diffusing the study of natural theology. With natural theology defined as the knowledge of God and the foundation of ethics or morals. The first Gifford Lectures were delivered in 1888, and at the University of Edinburgh, our past Gifford Lectures have included such luminaries as William James, Henri Bergson, James G. Fraser, Albert Schweitzer, Reinhold Niebuhr, Iris Murdoch, Charles Taylor, and Rowan Williams. Our Gifford Lecture for the session 2016 to 17 is a worthy member of this distinguished company. He is Professor Jeffrey Stout, Professor of Religion at Princeton University, and a philosopher of considerable breadth of interests, who's perhaps best known for his analyses of religious involvement in politics and his critical explorations of secularism and traditionalism. His recent writings have focused on conceptions of religion and critiques of arbitrary power. Jeffrey Stout was born in New Jersey and educated at Brown University and at Princeton University, where he earned his doctorate in religious studies. Princeton recognized his quality and kept him, giving him his first teaching position in 1975. He was appointed professor of religion in 1988, and he continues in that position to the present day. He chaired the Department of Religion at Princeton for several years, and he has won awards for teaching excellence. He's lectured widely across North America and Europe, and he was elected to the prestigious American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 2008. His books include The Flight from Authority, Religion, Morality, and the Quest for Autonomy, 1981, which was the first volume of the Distinguished Revisions series, edited by Alistair MacIntyre and Stanley Hauerwas. Then there was Ethics After Babel, The Languages of Morals and Their Discontents, 1988, which was the winner of the 1989 American Academy of Religion Award for Excellence. Then Democracy and Tradition, 2004, which was winner of the 2004 American Academy of Religion Award for Excellence. Grammar and Grace, Reformulations of Aquinas and Wittgenstein, 2004. And Blessed Are the Organized, Grassroots Democracy in America, 2010. He is also the author of some 80 journal articles and contributed book chapters, ranging widely across his disciplines. The title of his series of Gifford Lectures is Religion Unbound, Ideals and Powers from Cicero to King. And over the next 2 weeks, we will have 6 lectures. The lecture and the question time this evening are being recorded and the video will shortly be available online on the university's Gifford website. Professor Stout, could I now invite you to present the first of your Gifford lectures on Religion Since Cicero, which, among other themes, will explore the ideals of ethical religion, which have played such a vital role in modern freedom movements. Professor Stout.
Thank you for Professor Brown for that wonderful, generous introduction. Thanks to the Gifford Committee for inviting me to speak, to Anna Conroy and various others for assistance, and to many others for hospitality. It is a humbling honor to stand where my standard setters stood, assaying ideals and powers in troubled times. William James, in a Gifford lecture on the sick soul, said that, quote, the real core of the religious problem is help, help. I shall be focusing on cries for help in the face of tyranny and oppression. The topic is timely and long bound to religion. It was a topic close to the heart of James' godfather, Ralph Waldo Emerson, when he delivered at least 10 lectures in Scotland in 1848, at a moment when revolutionary fervor and reactionary fear were sweeping through Europe. Adam Lord Gifford recalled having attended 4 lectures by Emerson in that year, at the age of 27. A quarter century later, speaking in Glasgow City Hall, Lord Gifford confessed that the quote-unquote overflowing enthusiasm he felt while listening to Emerson, back when he was 27, when Lord Gifford was 27, had not subsided. Some of the young man's elders and peers sought to dampen such enthusiasm for Emerson. Pamphleteers and journalists described him as a heretic, an atomistic individualist, and a chimera stirring dangerously Republican passions. Scots read Emerson's 1844 essay collection in pirated as well as licit editions. Carlyle consoled Emerson by saying that while pirates rob your gold, they do carry you faster abroad. Young people hoping for reform had been disappointed by Carlyle's slide from their admiration. Emerson was their new west wind. Pamphlet versions of Man the Reformer and Emerson's first abolitionist address were being read across class lines. In Liverpool and Manchester, but not in Edinburgh, Emerson scheduled lectures for working class people. The Great Hunger had entered its third year. Newspapers reported riots. Emerson dined with aristocrats, toured British slums, and twice posed for David Scott's portrait of him during that visit to Scotland. In 1872, in that speech in Glasgow, Gifford remarked that, quote, authentic invitations onward and upward seem to come to us in a brother's voice when Emerson speaks or writes. He calls us out of tyranny and slavery. He endorses no separation of religion from political action because, as Gifford put it, religion will not be separated from anything whatever. True religion embodies worthy ideals in action. You cannot produce and you cannot maintain a religious vacuum, said Gifford. And if you could, even secularism would die in it. Emerson had recently said, religion is as inexpugnable as the use of lamps or of wells or of chimneys. Perhaps I should use his clenched fist, a characteristic gesture of Emerson's. The portraitist got that right. The dikes we erect to contain religion's influence are more permeable and fragile than we suppose. A sudden storm of moral indignation can wash them away. Religion has political effects whenever the stakes are high. The effects are good if the religion is good, and bad if the religion is bad. Religion is good when it embodies the highest ideals we know. It goes bad when infected by injustice. As Gifford said on another occasion, if injustice reigns and wrong prevails around us, it is impossible for us to avoid the contact and the contagion. Because Bernard of Clairvaux, on whom Lord Gifford gave another lecture, hated all tyranny but the tyranny of the church, his considerable virtue left much to be desired in Lord Gifford's eyes. Latter-day Christians should know better and do better. It is cause for shame, from Lord Gifford's point of view, that modern Christians were, quote, proprietors of slave ships. Christian planters bought cargoes of slaves. Christian churches and ministers were supported by the labor of the stolen Negroes, unquote. The religious defenders of tyranny and oppression bind religion to vice. The remedy is not to secularize politics, according to Lord Gifford, but to rectify religious attitudes and practices. When religion abides by justice and liberty, rather than bowing to arbitrary power, it lifts each of us and promotes the common good. This was Emerson's hope, as well as Lord Gifford's. It was the hope of William Wilberforce, Thomas Clarkson, and Abraham Lincoln, David Walker, Henry Highland Garnett, and Frederick Douglass, Margaret Fuller, Jose Marti, and John Muir, Mary Wollstonecraft, Lucretia Mott, and Jane Addams, Mohandas Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Malcolm X, Abraham Joshua Heschel, Thomas Merton, and William R. Johnson. To my knowledge, we have no adequate analysis of this hope, no adequate history of it. I cannot fill that gap in these six lectures, but I can give my reasons for wanting it filled. Many intellectuals posit a great separation of religion from politics in modernity. There are disputes over how the great separation was achieved, whether its effects were good, bad, or mixed, whether it was permanent or temporary. The disputes assume, however, that a great separation took place, that we know what it was, and that it set the terms in which politics was conducted, where and while it lasted. What then are we to make of the names that I listed a moment ago? Gandhi aspired to integrate his religious commitments and public witness. He thought that India's struggle for independence would fail if the religious and secular opponents of imperial rule did not cooperate. While denying that religion and politics could be neatly separated, he strove to free Indian religion as well as Indian society from tyranny and oppression. King did something similar on behalf of an American coalition that mixed religious and secular elements. A photograph that shows King, the Baptist preacher, and James Baldwin, the secular essayist, standing arm in arm, condenses the cooperative structure of the civil rights movement into a single image. There are similar photos of Gandhi and Nehru, Tutu and Mandela, Walesa and Meeknik. Each of the underlying movements consisted in myriad less visible friendships across lines of difference for the sake of a shared concern. Like Baldwin, Emerson was an ex-preacher turned essayist. At abolitionist rallies, he shared the speaker's platform with white preachers and fugitive slaves. The movement was a coalition of religious and secular citizens aligned against a coalition of religious and secular citizens. The same is true of feminism, the labor movement, the base communities in Latin America, solidarity in Poland, the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, the gay rights alliances that formed in San Francisco, New York, and Ottawa in the 1960s, and the environmentalist communities now forming nearly everywhere. That's a lot of political activity to go missing from one's account of modernity. And it covers every decade since the future Lord Gifford heard Emerson lecture in Edinburgh. Where was it then that the great separation transpired? What was separated from what? And in what ways? If you only had the most prominent theorists of modernity to go on, you might not know that Gandhi and King existed. It's hard to find their names in those books. You might think that until the recent resurgence of theocratic right-wing movements, religion had long been privatized and politics thoroughly secularized. You might think that the medieval world gathered harmoniously under a sacred canopy, worshiping a transcendent god, inculcating the virtues. Once there was no secular, then everything changed. Belief became a choice, rights vanquished virtue, religion was privatized, so we are told. My question is this: how would our understanding of religion and politics have to change if the religious voices in egalitarian freedom movements were given their due? That's the question that I hope to answer in this series. My answer will be historical, philosophical, and somewhat personal. A choice of inheritance explains my motivation, as well as my selection and juxtaposition of examples. I became interested in religion and politics while participating in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement as a teenager. Among the writers who mattered most to me then were Baldwin, King, Gandhi, and Emerson. These modern opponents of tyranny and oppression also said a great deal about religion and its relation to politics. They distinguished ethical, virtuous, or true religion from unethical, vicious, or false religion. I was puzzled about how to reconcile my own version of that distinction with my reading in philosophy, political theory, and religious studies, disciplines where the great separation story held sway and still holds sway. I gradually realized that if I wanted to make sense of my own thinking about religion and politics, I needed to locate it in a broader history. I first tried doing that moving back several centuries, and then realized that to have real success, I'd have to locate my own thinking and the struggles of my own times in a history that goes back as far as ancient Rome, a history of contestation over the key terms, religion, tyranny, oppression. Liberal secularism, ideology critique, the genealogy of morals, value-free social science, and King's letter from a Birmingham jail all make more sense when we take that history into account. Over and over again, in an ever-widening international context, someone has referred to something or other as religion and drawn political implications from this. Someone else has disagreed, and conflict has ensued. One of my tasks will be to clarify the topic being disputed and the stakes of the dispute, what the key terms denote, what reasons are given for their application, what consequences are said to follow from their proper application, and how religion differs from other kinds of things. In religion talk, the relevant kinds are often species of good and bad. Religion has been said to be virtuous and vicious, rational and irrational, sane and delusory, essential to the common good and best kept private, beneficial to freedom and detrimental to it, morality's foundation, its fruit, and its nemesis, a pillar of just order and the opium of the people, an indispensable source of meaning, and a conversation stopper. Religion talk can be as confusing, then, as it is contentious. It's not clear what's being referred to when the term is used. It requires philosophical clarification. Locke, Hume, Wollstonecraft, Marx, Emerson, Nietzsche, Pope Leo XIII, and Gandhi did not all have the same thing in mind when they spoke of religion. The disputes I am analyzing in these lectures are not disputes over the same thing. Quite different matters have been contested under the heading of religion. There is no such thing as the modern conception of religion to analyze, endorse, or vilify. So I shall speak instead of the modern discourse of religion, meaning by this the many uses of a single vocabulary rooted in ancient Rome. The earliest extant writings on our topic, in those writings, the Latin term religio is used to discuss a wide range of topics: divine worship, sacrifice, supplication, divination, consecration, avowal, prayer, and associated practices, the moral and political functions of these practices, the beliefs, passions, and dispositions acquired and expressed by participating in these practices, the rules for conducting and scheduling public rites, and the duties and institutions of the priesthood. That's already a very wide range of meanings, okay? But they're all related to one another. The Roman writers often used the term religion in neutral descriptions of these things, but in contexts where religion is implicitly or explicitly contrasted with superstition, use of the former term, religion, expresses a positive valuation of something, while use of the latter term is pejorative. The first century writer Varro tied down the contrast, according to St. Augustine, by saying that whereas the superstitious fear the gods, the religious revere the gods as benevolent parents. So there's one way of drawing the distinction. Many Roman writers alternate between neutral and value-laden ways of referring to acts, attitudes, dispositions, practices, obligations, roles, and institutions that are related in some way or other to divine worship and devotion. A concept that permits such variation, alternation, is what philosophers call a dual character concept. So the term scientist has a dual character in English, in contemporary English. Some scientists, in the sense of people who in fact earn their living by studying science, are said to be true or real scientists, while others are said not to be. True scientists belong to the relevant profession, but are also thought to exhibit excellence as practitioners of that profession relative to one or another standard or ideal. Donald Trump and Greenpeace agree on who earns their living as a scientist, but differ over who the true scientists are. Varro and Augustine agreed on who engaged in worship and devotion, but differed over who was truly religious. Debates over the distinction between true religion and its counterfeits or semblances bear on ethics and politics as well as on theology. And in this series, I'm going to be looking at the ethics and politics connections. When using the term to express positive evaluative judgments, Cicero associated religion with the moral virtues of justice and piety. He distinguished between religion and superstition from a point of view favorable to liberty, as he understood it, and unfavorable to tyranny and oppression. The ideals of the Roman Republic informed his view of the public practices that should be used to foster virtuous reverence and devotion in the populace. Cicero's philosophical doubts about one or another theological claim did not diminish his commitment to viewing religion as an excellence conducive to the common good, as a virtue. When the historian Livy cited a deterioration of religion as a moral cause of political ills, he too was referring to a virtue and invoking evaluative standards. His History of Rome is a compendium of instructive examples. Good examples, such as Numa's establishment of state religion for the cultivation of popular virtue, are useful for imitation, according to Livy. Bad examples, such as Manlius's religious demagoguery, are precedents to avoid. Each chief example, discussed in Book 5 of Livy's history, makes clear that national piety leads to success. Piety and impiety, respectively, explain good and bad outcomes, and do so in a way that does not necessarily depend on divine intervention, from Livy's point of view. Seneca, though an apologist for monarchy, rejected use of public worship on its behalf. True religion, he thought, is something the Stoic philosopher acquires in dispassionate communion with the gods, whereas public worship cannot help being superstitious. Many other monarchists, from Horace to Macrobius, agreed with Cicero and Livy that public worship has beneficial political effects, that it tends to be both expressive of virtue and conducive to its formation, and that officials would be wise to make provisions for inculcating and expressing it. Because these monarchists differed from republicans over what habits of reverence, devotion, and deference to express and cultivate, they also differed over what rituals to conduct and whom to worship. Not all evaluative uses of the concept of religion in ancient Rome were positive. The most influential precedent for using the term negatively was a poem by Lucretius, a follower of Epicurus in the late Roman Republic. That poem, entitled On the Nature of Things, repeatedly uses religio as the name of something inherently oppressive. Religion is not something that needs to be freed from oppression, as Lord Gifford and Cicero thought, but rather something from which we need to be freed, or something from which we need to free ourselves. As the poet surveys the world around him, he finds humankind, quote, miserably crushed before all eyes by religion, and he seeks to, quote, loose from round the mind religion's tightened coils. The ties that bind human beings to the gods are shackles to be thrown off, not obligations to be honored. For Lucretius, religion unbound or ethical religion would be a contradiction in terms. After Constantine's conversion, beginning with the Divine Institutes of Lactantius, Christians adapted the positive use of religion to their own ecclesial and political purposes, avoiding negative uses of the term. Augustine treated it as the name of a moral virtue and contrasted it with the vices of superstition he took to be characteristic of Greek and Roman paganism. His value-laden religion talk anointed a pagan concept for use against pagans and heretics. While the rulers of medieval Christendom settled for the status of divinely sanctioned sovereignty rather than the still higher status of divinity, they maintained the pagan tradition of treating religion as a virtue term. Like Augustus before them, they had a political interest in harnessing the formative and expressive functions of religion to monarchical power. The European Middle Ages were never as Christian, however, as Christian monarchs and prelates wished. The Jews, Moors, Turks, Slavs, sectarians, dissidents, and countless undocumented sacrament evaders of the medieval period resisted assimilation into what Christendom called true religion. There would have been no need to classify such people as superstitious or heretical had they not posed significant threats to religious unity. A value-laden contrast between the virtue of religion and contrasting vices was one of the primary means the medieval church used to maintain and extend its hegemony. But the suppression of superstition and heresy were always expensive, sometimes violent, and much less than perfectly successful. Erasure of pre-modern difference is a disturbingly common plot device in books on religion and modern politics. My reason for not telling a story about the modern loss of an earlier religious harmony is that there was no such harmony to be lost. The most systematic account of a positive conception of religion is to be found in Thomas Aquinas's Summary of Theology, a work undertaken between 1265 and 1274 in order to improve the instruction of his fellow Dominicans. Thomas sometimes used the term religio neutrally to describe practices related to worship and devotion, but never negatively. When he wished to underscore a positive value judgment, he spoke of true religion, as Augustine and others had done before him. Thomas theorizes religion as a virtue, while also using the term to designate any attitude, practice, or institution thought to express or foster the authentic virtue. His talk of virtue and vice is, of course, evaluative. That's what virtue and vice talk is supposed to be. It invokes standards of proper evaluation regarding the character of persons and communities. The Summa makes explicit what it takes those standards to be. That's part of the point of the book. Superstition is the book's umbrella concept for various worship-related vices. When he uses religio positively to refer to practices and institutions, Thomas assumes these to have formative and expressive functions in a life of Christian virtue. The practices form the worshiper's soul to act in accord with virtue, and they do this by orienting the soul attitudinally toward the true God and by giving the soul fitting interior and outward means of expressing honor, veneration, reverence, and devotion to God. Repeated use of those means ideally builds up the good habit in which the virtue consists. Virtues for Aquinas are good habits. Officials are responsible for orienting ritual practice to its proper formative and expressive ends, that is, its intended mundane functions. In the background is Cicero's schema of cardinal moral virtues, which Thomas elaborates in precise detail, Thomas Aquinas being one of the most precise minds ever to put pen to paper. A virtue is an excellence of character, which disposes the person who has it to have appropriate passions and to act rightly for the right reasons across many circumstances. There are four cardinal virtues, all of which bear on political as well as personal life. Courage, temperance, practical wisdom, and justice are cardinal virtues. Justice is the virtue according to which each person in a relationship receives his or her due from another. It is the virtue directly concerned with bringing relationships among persons into right order. In many relationships, for example, among neighbors, justice is a reciprocal affair. Suppose I am your neighbor and you borrow my axe. If you return it in good condition, in timely fashion, and with appropriate thanks, and if you show a willingness to help me out in similar ways on other occasions, our relationship is square. Suppose, however, that you break my axe through negligence, or simply fail to return it, or withhold appropriate thanks, refuse to reciprocate, don't repair the broken axe. Well, then our relationship is out of whack. Doing this sort of thing habitually would make you unjust, insofar as you habitually set your neighborly relations right, you are a just neighbor. That's the lingo here. Now, not all relationships, according to Thomas, are governed by simple reciprocity. My parents are, in Thomas's words, sources of my existence and progress through life. I am indebted to them for my life and for my upbringing. Repaying them in kind is impossible. Nothing I could do would make the relationship square. We will never be even. Other things being equal, however, I am obliged to honor them, express my gratitude to them, and acknowledge my dependence on them. If I do these things well and for the right reasons, I am acting justly, but without setting our relationship square. Piety is the virtue that concerns giving due honor and devotion to my parents or my people. Religion, for Thomas is the virtue that concerns giving due honor and devotion to God. Thomas usually reserves the term pietas for filial and patriotic piety, but recognizes that in the tradition it is sometimes used more broadly to cover religion as well. And we will see this throughout this lecture series. In the broader usage, the paradigmatic foci of piety are one's parents, one's people, notables, Thomas calls them, including holders of high office, people whose actions have contributed greatly to the development of one's culture, people like that, and God. So parents, people, notables, God. With respect to our relationships to each of those, they are sources of our existence and progress through life, and from Thomas's, according to Thomas's account, we have certain obligations of justice to them, but they aren't such that we can put the relationship square. So Thomas describes both religion and piety in the strict sense, as potential parts of justice. And this technical term distinguishes these virtues from justice among equals, which can reasonably aspire to completion in symmetrical mutuality, setting square the relationship. Religion and piety are concerned with relationships of dependence that must, by their nature, remain asymmetrical. These virtues are concerned with what we owe to the sources of our existence and progress through life. They are virtues of justly acknowledged, irreversible relations of dependence. When the term religion is used to designate a virtue, the term's application to someone, this person has religion, this person's religious, the term's application to someone involves a positive judgment of her or him. Use of the term is constrained by an ideal of worship, devotion, and so forth. Similarly, for Thomas, applying the term king to someone implies a positive judgment of that person's entitlement to rule. He doesn't call tyrants kings. They are not true kings. They are false. Right. See how the terminology works? So using the term king, applying it to someone, implies a positive judgment of that person's entitlement to rule and of his character, given that he cannot possess the entitlement to rule, for reasons we'll discover in this lecture series, while ruling primarily for the sake of his own private good rather than for the common good. If his character is so constituted that he rules for his own private good, or for the good of a faction over against the common good, he's a tyrant. So use of certain terms is constrained by ideals. King by an ideal of proper rule, entitlement to rule. Religion by an ideal of proper worship, devotion, and so forth. Religion in the positive sense is both essentially good and, from Thomas's point of view, essentially connected to public political life. In locating religion among the virtues, Thomas contrasts it with the corresponding vice of superstition. And he uses a perfectionist Christian vocabulary to pinpoint how potential converts, wayward Christian lay people, popes, magistrates, and others fall short of virtue while relating themselves to the divine source of their existence and progress through life. Our Creator, according to Thomas, is the perfectly good God who desires that we enter fully into proper relationship with one another and proper relationship with God. God created us for this. Excellent, rightly ordered fellowship among human beings and proper relation to God is the end for which human beings have been created, and the condition in which our true happiness consists. The virtues are excellent in themselves, indispensable as means for the achievement of proper relationship, and essential to what makes proper relationship excellent. Behaving viciously, as in murder, rape, tyranny, oppression, and superstition, tends by nature to alienate us from God and from fellowship in virtue with our fellow human beings and God. Religion is the virtue that bears most directly on perfection of our relationship to God. Now, the trouble with virtues, says Thomas, is that they have semblances, false lookalikes. The semblances of virtues are vices. Murder and theft can masquerade as justice. Vengeance is a semblance of retributive justice. Rashness is a semblance of courage. Indifference to evil can be a semblance of tolerance. The semblances of religion are the vices of superstition. A superstitious person either worships what is unworthy of worship or worships God in an undue manner. Idolatry gives to a creature the honor due to the Creator, whereas various divinatory practices get the means of devotion wrong. So you can get wrong what object is the worship or devotion is being directed to, or you can get the means wrong. Okay? Superstition is not religion, strictly speaking, because it is not virtuous. It has the same relation to true religion that counterfeit money has to legal tender, or that climate change denial has to true science. Superstition, like the virtue of true religion, is psychologically rooted in the natural human inclination to seek help from, to honor, and to achieve right relation to a benevolent higher power. But someone giving expression to that inclination can easily go wrong. So everybody has that inclination built in and then can go wrong. A person can confuse apparent sources of help with the true, ultimate, completely dependable source of help. It is possible to conflate a glorious feature of creation, such as the sun, with its creator. We can honor a worthless artifact, an imaginary being, or an emperor as the highest one. People can also entreat, honor, or otherwise relate to the highest one in inappropriate ways. We can, but we shouldn't, according to Thomas. Religion, strictly speaking, is virtuous or ethical religion. Okay. On our mad rush through conceptual history, we now turn to the modern period. My reason for introducing Thomas's account of religion at some length, and I will say more about Thomas in the next couple of lectures, But my reason for introducing it is not to treat it as the hegemonic medieval view, it wasn't, but rather to use it as a baseline of comparison when discussing modern writers in this and later lectures. Next time, I shall be discussing Las Casas and Savonarola, mainly Las Casas, two Dominicans, so members of the same order that Thomas was writing for and belonged to, who were required to read Thomas's Summary of Theology in seminary and used its carefully defined terminology when discussing religion in their own context more than two centuries after Thomas's death. It is hardly surprising to find Thomistic religion talk among Thomists. What do we discover when we turn to Machiavelli, Althusius, Hooker, Ferguson, Wilberforce, Wollstonecraft, Harriet Martineau, Emerson, Lord Gifford, Kuyper, Pope Leo XIII, Gandhi, and King? Well, we find, I think, that all of these writers took true religion as they conceived of it to be virtuous. They connected it to piety and justice and distinguished it from superstition. Most of them explicitly described it as a virtue of properly acknowledged dependence and remarked on the ethical and political significance of its formative and expressive functions. Of course, not all value-laden uses of the term religion in the modern period have been positive. A scribe who later served as a papal secretary rediscovered the Lucretius poem in 1417, and several printed editions were issued before 1500. By 1700, negative uses of the term religion had caught on a bit, but without ever pushing the positive uses of the term out of circulation. Baron d'Holbach, Robert Owen, Marx, Engels, Lenin, Mao, Freud, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Gloria Steinem, and Bill Maher have largely used the term pejoratively in accordance with the Lucretian precedent. In their usage, religion is essentially oppressive. Religions cause wars, hold back progress, sow irrationality and fear, oppress the human mind, and legitimize domination. So positive and negative uses of the terms and the characters involved often talking past each other. Machiavelli copied out the Lucretian poem in his own hand, in its entirety, as a young man in the 1490s, but later cast his own influential account of religion as a series of discourses on Livy's History of Rome. Machiavelli favored the Livian over the Lucretian usage because he wanted to use the contrast between true religion and its semblances in explanations of good and bad outcomes, in a way modeled somewhat on Livy's way. In his discourses, Book 1, Chapter 10, after noting that founders of religion are the most praised of men, he warned that nearly everyone is deceived by semblances of the good. Now, many of the examples Machiavelli discusses in chapters 11 through 15 of Book 1 of the Discourses turn out to be more ambiguous than they initially appear, and more ambiguous than their analogs in Livy's history. It's part of the pedagogical purpose of Machiavelli's discourses to create problems for the reader, to make it hard to figure out what are the semblances and what are in his view. But a few clear points emerge. Chapter 11 refers to keeping men good as a function of religion. chapter 12 advises anyone who wishes to keep a republic free from corruption to keep its religious practices free of corruption. The prime example of a corrupted political use of religion is appealing to oracles, or by implication, scriptures, so as to make them, and here's another Machiavelli phrase, so as to make them speak in the mode of the powerful. In other words, so as to make the scriptures support the interest of the powerful. Respectful fear of God melds with the common good in the heart of a good citizen, according to Machiavelli. Prudent leaders help the melding along. Moral corruption, often in the form of avarice, is a greater threat to the commonwealth than false belief. Italy had suffered both politically and religiously as a result of corruption in the church, according to Machiavelli. It was proximity to the bad example of the court of Rome that explained loss of religion, loss of true religion in Italy. So proximity to that bad example was what, this is a passage of Machiavelli that will have echoes in later lectures as we turn to later figures. While the voluntary poverty of the Franciscans and the Dominicans had reduced religious corruption, their misinterpretation of Christian love, according to Machiavelli, had left Italian city-states weak. To put it in contemporary language, they confused love with niceness. The armed Christian patriots of the Swiss cantons were Machiavelli's model modern citizens. It should be kept in mind that he entered the Florentine chancery just after the execution of Savonarola, a Dominican friar with no adequate means to defend either himself or the Florentine Republic from Vatican tyranny. Okay. Baruch Spinoza, James Harrington, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Giuseppe Mazzini were Republican admirers of Machiavelli who contributed heavily to modern thinking about the political importance of virtuous religion. Alexis de Tocqueville's republicanism was less indebted to Machiavelli, but no less concerned with the public effects of good and bad religion. Emile Durkheim defined, so another Republican, somewhat less influenced by Machiavelli than the four I mentioned a moment ago, defined religion as a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things that unite its adherents in a single moral community. Again, religion is essentially public. Religion's unifying public function is evident, Durkheim thought, when one looks at societies with minimal division of labor. A central challenge for modern republics, and this is another theorist of republican life, right? A central challenge for modern republics is to unite multiple secondary groups in commitment to a shared conception of the sacred, which, according to Durkheim, need not be linked to a shared conception of divinity. Because republicanism is largely missing from most overviews of religion and modern thought, the significance of attempts to modify or reject its main ideas tends to be obscured. One effect of leaving republicanism out of the story is the false impression, now widespread among academics, that there is something worth calling the modern conception of religion, according to which religion is essentially or ideally a private matter to be screened out of public life to the extent possible. David Hume's criticisms of monkish virtue were as harsh as Machiavelli's, but not motivated by a Republican ideal of true religion's public role or a Republican ideal of liberty. Hume granted that true religion is essentially good, but also hinted that its rarity and lack of determinate practical implications left it irrelevant to politics. It is a virtue possessed by only a handful of skeptical philosophers and consists in a calm piety for a vaguely defined first cause. So if it is that, no positive practical implications follow from it. The first cause on which we depend does not appear to be much of a lover. Belief in a benevolent deity with maximal power is hard to reconcile with the evils all around us. A wise philosopher does not place much confidence in beliefs about first things or infer political conclusions from those beliefs. No established religion can be expected to instill the true virtue, according to Hume, because that is accessible only to true philosophers. But this conclusion does not prevent us from asking which religion that could be established in some territory strikes the best balance between authority and liberty. On such prudential grounds, Hume endorsed moderate Anglicanism as a way of cultivating a somewhat virtuous populace in England. But Hume's notion of liberty, as we will see in later lectures, was not Machiavelli's, and a natural history of religion leaves little reason to think that true religion can get a stable foothold in human nature, as Hume understands it. Hume's essay on two species of false religion, superstition and enthusiasm, reinforces the suspicion. Worship administered by priestly elites tends toward superstition, in his use of the word. And superstition inhibits the progress of enlightened sentiments. Spontaneous worship tends toward enthusiasm, which foments violence and faction. Superstition is imposed from above, whereas enthusiasm erupts from below. Hume's admission that enthusiasm is friendly to liberty, by which he really meant license, the freedom to do as you wish without being obstructed, okay, did not prevent him from classifying enthusiasm as a vice. Too much liberty, too much license, undermines the authority needed to maintain order and peace. An acceptable religious establishment exerts authority gently while leaving some room, but not too much, for liberty. Olbach's friends rejected this prudential argument and mocked Hume's refusal to avow atheism. Hume viewed Parisian atheism with suspicion. It was another species of enthusiasm, a rationalist ally of unmitigated Republican liberty. Hume's genius can blind us to what was going on around him. Thomas Arnert of the Edinburgh faculty has demonstrated that the Scottish Enlightenment was largely a religious affair. For Hutcheson, Ferguson, Reed, Beatty, James Oswald, and William Robertson, true religion is indeed a moral virtue of great importance to political life. It has mundane as well as supernatural ends. It needs cultivation. Its interpretation has implications for reform. Two concerns united the Scottish Enlightenment to the moderates of the 1750s and the heterodox Presbyterians who came before them. The first concern was a down-to-earth interest in setting right the morally formative function of religion. The second was a suspicion of speculation's tendency to distract a thinker from the demands of living well. These themes are developed beautifully in Onert's book on the Scottish Enlightenment. Beattie is an interesting figure. Beattie was an important philosopher in the Scottish Enlightenment, religiously disposed, influenced by Thomas Reed, also an important abolitionist. Beattie's abolitionist allies outside the academy shared these concerns that I just outlined. Historians have recently done much to highlight the role of religious voices in such movements, in reform movements, as well as in the Enlightenment. But it seems to me that the deeper significance of such scholarship has yet to be adequately stated, let alone publicized or plumbed. If the Enlightenment era didn't achieve a great separation of religion from politics, which is what's suggested by the close order historical work on both the Enlightenment and reform movements in this period, then what account should we be giving? Well, you'll be pleased to hear that I'm nearing my conclusion. Lord Gifford chose his words carefully when he spoke of his overflowing enthusiasm for Emerson. That word enthusiasm mattered. The American visitor's enthusiasm for liberty, liberty in something more like Machiavelli's sense than Hume's, we'll talk about what that difference involves in later lectures, but the American visitor's enthusiasm for liberty in a sense that would align Emerson with abolition of slavery, right, as a reform movement, was proof that religious enthusiasm can bear public fruit. But Emerson also denied Hume's claim that enthusiasm is inherently vicious. What beneficial transformation has ever transpired in human history without enthusiasm? Emerson asked. And his answer, not the emergence of Christianity, not the Protestant Reformation, and not the abolition of slavery in the British Empire. Lord Gifford agreed. Gifford lecturers, according to the bequest, are to discuss natural theology in the widest sense of that term, that's the way the Gifford bequest puts it, and to treat their subject as a strictly natural science. Do we know what he meant by that? If his own public lectures are any indication, he did not mean value-free inquiry. Gifford lecturers may be, as the bequest puts it, of any denomination whatever, or of no denomination at all, but need to be reverent. I have my doubts about some previous Gifford lecturers on these points. Their task is to address such topics as the foundation of ethics or morals without taking for granted, as the bequest puts it, faith in so-called miraculous revelation. Lord Gifford's admiration of what he called the anti-slavery feelings which are manifest throughout Emerson's writings comes across strongly in the 1872 lecture on Emerson in Glasgow. After a long quotation from an ode that includes the line, "Go put your creed in your deed," and the wish that the Atlantic will become, quote, "a fairy of the free." This is Emerson saying, not the place where slave ships go. All right. Lord Gifford concludes the lecture by saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, I can read you nothing better than that." One of the British abolitionists who pushed Emerson to join the movement, and did so somewhat too publicly, he thought, was Harriet Martineau. When a threatening mob formed after Martineau's anti-slavery speech in Boston in 1835, her refuge was Emerson's farm in Concord. Her ethnography, Society in America, includes chapters entitled Religion, Science of Religion, and Spirit of Religion. She looks forward to a day, quote, when all shall have the comprehension of mind and range of knowledge which are requisite for investigating spiritual relations, testing the interpretations which have been put upon them from age to age. The time may possibly come when all may be able thus to be scientific in theology, unquote. She says, quote, the only test by which religion and superstition can be ultimately tried is by their fruits ye shall know them, unquote. It would be superstition to worship a God who tolerated slavery. Such a being would be an idol, not the true God. Quote, the office of theological science is to trace corruptions of religion to their source and separate them from the pure waters of truth, unquote. The scientific test Martineau proposes is essentially moral, because, as she puts it, quote, religion comes out of morals. Quote, if religion springs from morals, the religion must be most faulty where the morals are so, unquote. I wonder whether Lord Gifford read those lines. Religion, according to Martineau in 1837, is a moral matter. It is not going away. It is most faulty where the morals are so. To distinguish its corrupt from true, its corrupt from its true forms, we must assess its fruits. She offered the following assessment of American Presbyterians. Quote, some of the most noble of the abolitionists of the North are Presbyterians, and from the lips and pens of Presbyterians in the South come some of the defenses of slavery which evince the deepest depravity of principle and feeling. With a few exceptions, the religion of the South strictly accords with the morals of the South. Christianity is severed there from its radical principles of justice and liberty, and it will have to be cast out as a rotten branch. 4 days before Emerson concluded his Edinburgh lectures in February 1848, revolution broke out in Paris. When he left Edinburgh, he visited Martineau, who was undergoing a crisis of faith. He was now a prominent abolitionist, as she had hoped a decade earlier. He was wondering what the current moment demanded of him. After a brief stay in Ambleside and a disappointing conversation with an aging poet named Wordsworth, Emerson headed off to Paris to witness the revolution firsthand. Thank you very much.
As you began to speak, I began to ask myself why you were beginning with Cicero and Seneca rather than Plato, Sophocles, and Euripides. But then it became obvious as you linked what you had said to Aquinas and to Machiavelli. Had it ever struck you that you could have gone further back than Cicero to early Roman private law, to the Law of the Twelve Tables, which were formulated to broker the rights between the patricians and the plebeians, and that might have given you another non-religious point of entry?
So let's get the real point of Professor Torrance's question is, could you do more than two millennia, Professor Stone? The answer to your question is yes, it did occur to me. And
I think it will be clear from later lectures that it is the it is Cicero, Livy, Sallust, Tacitus who matter more for the later stages of the discussion. There's already a discourse surrounding the notion of religion in those earlier documents, and they matter to the they matter to the writers I'm emphasizing, who are right at the cusp of the move from Republican Rome to its successor. And that contrast between Republican thinking and monarchical thinking is going to be very important for what I'm doing in the later lectures. So that's why I'm emphasizing it. The notions of freedom and religion in Roman law are extremely important to the whole story, though, actually. So the on the freedom side, the contrast between the status of a citizen and the status of a slave, and then the contrast between a free man and a slave, this is an extremely important contrast for the later, the early modern and later modern writers. And this is going to play an important role. This is why I'm emphasizing the transition from Republican Rome to the loss of the Republic. I should just add that a reason that I'm not going back into the Greek sources is that I'm trying to take seriously the semantics of the terminology itself. Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much for your talk. And this is probably going to be quite an obvious question from the end of your talk, which comes up: if you're going to judge religion by its moral outcomes, by its fruits, does that mean then that morality precedes that religion? And if so, then where does that morality come from? Because it cannot be based on religion. It has to come from somewhere else. And I wonder what your take is on that.
Right. So the first thing to emphasize is that within Thomas's framework, religion is a moral virtue. It's we will see when we get to lecture three that it contrasts with his account of faith as a theological virtue. When we get to lecture three, we're going to be looking at early modern controversies over the relation between religion as a moral virtue and faith as a divinely given infused virtue. And the real answer to your question will be developed in that lecture. So it's important to keep in mind that for this long tradition, religion is understood as a moral notion and not to be conflated with the theological virtue of faith. I won't say much about faith at all until lecture three, because we're going to stay in the part of Thomas's schema that falls under the four cardinal moral virtues. Now, religion is important as a moral virtue because the practices of religion help on this conception to shape someone into a moral being. It is by engaging in repeated acts of worship and devotion that the moral self is formed. So that's partly why religion is given so much political emphasis, because this soulcraft as something for which leaders are responsible. The question is, how can the sorts of people be created who will be responsible members of society? Now, what kind of person that would be is looks like one thing if you're a Republican and like another thing if you're a monarchist, and that's one of the contrasts that we'll be discussing in later lectures. So does this help at all? You see the... it's somewhat anachronistic to use our notions of religion and morality as separate spheres and project them back onto this earlier period. Part of what I'm doing in this lecture series is, in effect, an anti-anachronistic method of looking at the history, seeing if we can get a different angle on the present by taking seriously how people from earlier centuries use the key terms. And by shedding light on that, allowing some aspects of very recent history to come to light in a way that helps overcome the eclipse to which they've been subjected.
Thank you very much. Well, forgive me for asking this very simplistic question, but do you have a spectrum by which you would judge Obama and Trump? And do you have a spectrum by which you would judge Obama and Trump based on Aquinas' cardinal virtues? If at all, religion is worship, developing the moral virtues, etc., etc. One, you have Obama who went to church every Sunday. You've got Trump who doesn't go to church at all. You've got Trump who is supported by, quote unquote, the evangelical movement. So, Obama being the first black president, you also had your colleague, Dr. Cornel West, and Tava Smiley, being nemesis to Obama, criticizing him for everything he did. So in that light, do you have a spectrum by which you can judge these two people in light of the cardinal virtue of Aquinas?
Well, I think you will find as the lecture series unfolds that more and more implications, most of them left at the level of implication and not drawn out explicitly, will emerge for the present, including judgment of figures like these. But let's, on the issue of religion, it's hard to know what to say about them. What's much clearer is what would need to be said about their habits of rule in relation to the categories of tyranny and oppression. Now, in this lecture, I haven't even defined those categories yet, but at the beginning of the next one, the first section of that lecture will be a discussion of the notions of tyranny and oppression and the importance of distinguishing them. Now, to be very brief, to give you a foretaste, if tyranny is, by definition, for this Dominican tradition, rule that is for some motive or reason other than genuine concern for the common good, typically avarice, right? Well, you can put Trump pretty far out on the spectrum of on the tyranny spectrum because of all of these concerns about ignoring issues with respect to conflict of interest, having his own family members and his own businesses benefit from his rule, not releasing the tax forms. These are all the sorts of issues that the tradition I'm explicating in the lecture series theorize under the category of tyranny. Personal benefit rather than benefit to the common good or benefit to a faction or a family So we have to think about that. But notice, Obama has just taken a $400,000 fee from Wall Street in order to give a speech. So the line, I'm not going to put Obama as far out on the spectrum as Trump. Trump has been the most egregious violator of anti-tyranny concerns of any recent American president, any American president I can think of. But Obama is still implicated in my view, in blurring the relevant lines between concern, demonstrably exemplifying concern for the common good. And what does that require? It requires making sacrifices with respect to your own private gain on matters relating to government. It would have been a splendid thing had Obama said when he stepped down from the presidency that he would step down in the way Washington did, as a self-conscious imitation of Cincinnatus, which is returning to private life in a way that cuts off the continued connection between private gain and governmental influence. But the issue of oppression ties into the notion of domination. And domination is a matter of being at the mercy of arbitrary power. The Trump administration is in various ways putting itself forward quite overtly as opposed to all checks on arbitrary power, with the model of Hungary, Poland, Turkey being the scariest precedents. Hungary's case being especially salient because of the wall and certain other features, but systematically going after all of the salient possible checks on executive power, beginning with the press, but extending to judicial counterpower, so on and so forth. Well, all of the separations of powers in a republic are designed as blocks on domination, blocks on checks and balances to prevent citizens from being subjected, being placed at the mercy of arbitrary power. That's a different matter from tyranny, though they often are linked because the motives of the tyrant ruling for private gain give additional reasons to oppress, to reduce others to conditions of servitude where you have complete control over them. When Plato theorizes this, to go back to the Greeks, he develops a psychological profile of the tyrant as one who has a natural tendency toward domination, because domination is a matter of subjecting others to absolute control, which Plato rightly, in my view, views as a form of self-deception on the tyrant's part. But look, Trump, very bad on both of the tyranny. But now think about Obama on the issues relating to domination. On matters relating to U.S. militarism and its domination of other countries, Obama made slight window dressing adjustments, but no serious attention to the basic issue. And on matters relating to surveillance, he basically left the keys to a domination surveillance machine sitting on the desk of the Oval Office. For Trump to make use of, but he was already making extensive use of it himself, and he was relying on the public's view of him as benevolent to draw attention away from the basic issue of domination, which is a matter of power imbalance. If you have a benevolent master, you're still a slave.
Hello. You said you didn't want to go back to the Greeks because of the etymology, but you used one term of Greek origin, which in a way was very important in the second part of your lecture, namely enthusiasm, and how it changed drastically from Hume to Emerson and 19th century. What I was wondering is, to what extent was it really kind of Hume's personal view, or was it just a shift in the view of, or in the term of enthusiasm, and the move from pejorative to positive meaning that happened between 16th, 17th, 18th century and then the 19th? And connected with that, God with it, in being in God. So, when did this term become secularized? Because I presume in the beginning the people were still probably, Hume was very aware of the fact that Theos is part of enthusiasm, whereas I think people writing in CVs nowadays, I'm very enthusiastic about this and this, probably are not.
Right. Well, I don't know the whole history of that term. There might be people in this audience who do. It's the language of religion itself that goes back into the Latin roots. But part of what I want to bring out in the entire lecture series is the thought that, how can I put this? Until relatively recently, the most influential users of the discourse of religion and the contrasting terms were educated in the classics. And that includes Greek and Latin. And it's if we take this seriously, we will have an important set of clues to seeing what the main ideas mean. And that's partly because for Machiavelli, for Milton, for Harrington, for Hume, for Hobbes, it's another matter, but I'll talk about him somewhat in Lecture 3, down through Emerson and Lincoln, or someone like Edmund Burke. These are people who expect their audiences, Lincoln and Emerson, it starts to get more ambiguous, but they expect their audiences, or at least a primary target aspect of their audience, to have been educated in the same way they have, to recognize the deployment of certain sentences as commonplaces, as the way you make moves in the relevant arguments, so that leaving one word out or adding a word to a recognizable sentence is the way you make your points, and it's because you know that your audience can recognize what you're doing and have also been trained in rhetoric, so they will recognize the overall stylistic effect of what you're doing. Once you get that in the picture, the history starts to make much more sense. In Hume's case, I think a primary precursor for him is Plutarch on superstition. So that might help draw the, connect the dots a little bit, but I'd love to know more.
I think we will need to draw the evening to a close. We've had an excellent first Gifford lecture, which is define the problem to be explored, the parameters, the terms that you'll be using. He opened with a very important reminder about how religion can inspire, can motivate selfless actions for social good. Style is both the art of the inclusion and the exclusion. And I think this was a brilliantly structured lecture. He spoke clearly, succinctly, but included what was needed, excluded what was needed to take us through 2,000 years of a narrative of religious discourse in the public sphere, Livy, Aquinas, Machiavelli, bringing us to Hume, important ideas, social justice, liberty under law. I was very pleased that he concluded with by citing my friend Thomas Arnaert's recent book on the moral culture of the Scottish Enlightenment, which he commended to all of us, and rightfully so. Lord Gifford would have been very pleased. I was particularly, I was struck by Lord Gifford's abolitionist commitments. It's something I wasn't aware of. I was very pleased that was drawn forward, because I think one of the themes of this lectures will not only be freedom, but also the continuing struggle against racism, which remains very real to us. We've had a superb first lecture. Could you join me, please, in thanking our speaker once again?